I did a search on the good old interweb. I was trying to find out how many Bible characters there were. Not numbers, but people in the Bible. And the number I came up with is about 3,200 and something people mentioned in the Bible. Obviously, that doesn't include when 300,000 got killed or something like that, but these are characters in the Bible. I think less than half are given by name. So one thing that we have here, for sure, is a lot of stories about a lot of people. And so I'd like to talk with you today about that. And I'll be more precise in a second, but just to get us going, I just want to think very briefly about the story of Elijah. So I don't think we need to turn there because we're all pretty familiar with it. No doubt about it, Elijah was an extraordinary character. He, I think, three times he called fire down from heaven. I mean, God did all this stuff, but three times. So two times it was to kill 50 people because he didn't like the soldiers coming at him. And then the other time was when he was in front of the whole lot of Israel and he pulled fire down from heaven to burn the cow. He raised a boy from the dead. He prayed that it wasn't going to rain and it didn't. And then he prayed again that it would rain and it did. There's a case where he outran a horse because he got superpowers for speed for some reason, not sure why. Extraordinary. And at the end of his life, he didn't have a funeral. He had a chariot of fire came down to take him away. So no doubt that Elijah was it's an exceptional story. And the interesting thing is you've got this amazing story. What are we meant to do with it today? What am I meant to tell my girls about the relevance of such an extraordinary story today? It's very interesting that James talks about Elijah, and he does so in a really strange way. Well, at least to me. At the end of James, if I could just turn I'll tell you in more details where we're going to go in a second. But if we can just go to James 5, verse 17. James 5, verse 17, it says, Elijah was a human being like us. He prayed fervently it might not rain. For 3 years, 6 months, it didn't rain. He prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth yielded its harvest. So James reckons that Elijah was just like us. And yet you've got this extraordinary story. So what do we do with this? I think James is trying to tell us that we have to find ways to identify with the characters in the Bible. Now, no, for most of you, that's not a new thing. But James is asking, saying, this incredible Elijah was a human being just like us. And so what I'd like to try to do today is to read some stories from the Bible characters. I won't read all the 3,200, but read some stories from the Bible characters and to try to help us identify with them. So this is a very personal thing. I'd like you to think about what you would do. Who do you identify with in the Bible? Because James, I think, says you've got to try and identify with them. You've got to say these were human beings just like us. And so if we're going to learn from them, I think we have to identify with them. So what I'd like to try and do is I'd like you to try and imagine that the Bible is a bit like a family photo album. And if you think about it, when you get around and you look at the family photo album, you go through it and you see things that went on and you have memories. But you also see things you identify with. You see how, Auntie Joni looks just like little such and such. Well, there's Uncle Fred, he's just like Jack. So what I'd like us to try and do now is to read the Bible as if, just for this moment, as if it's like a family photo album and see if you can spot the likeness. Because I think we have to identify with it. So these are like your uncles. Think of it like your uncles and aunts and see if you can spot the likeness. And we've started with Elijah. Very hard to spot the likeness, I admit, with Elijah, because he's calling fire down in heaven. What do we do with that? But anyway, I think there's a number of stories that I'd like to take us through, treating the Bible as if it's like the family photo album. And what's the aim? To try to help us reflect on identifying with the characters in here. How can we identify with the characters in the Bible? Now, I know some of these stories will be very familiar, and just like the family photo album, right? Some of the stories, not that again. It's going to set Mum off. She's going to tell us all about this. Well, that's what it's going to be like now. But still, you can spot the likeness. So, where does your family photo album start? It starts with babies, nearly always, right? So let's go to a couple of baby stories and see if we can spot any likenesses. So the first one I'd like to go to is the the baby story of Samuel and see if you can spot any likenesses in this story. So let's go to 1 Samuel 1. Now, we do have to make some effort here because there are different times, and it's what? This is about more than 3,000 years ago. So things are different, but I still think there's some likenesses to spot here. So let's try and find them. So let's go to 1 Samuel 1. So there was a certain man of Ramathim, a Ziphite in the hill country, whose name was Elkanah. He had two wives. So it's a bit hard to identify with this, right? But he had two wives. One was Hannah, the other was Penaniah. Penaniah had children. Hannah didn't. Now this man used to go up year by year from his town to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord. So, okay, there's a point of identification. We go to the feast each year, so there's one small point of identification, but let's read on. So on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he'd give portions to his wife and to her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her. And he thought, though the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival used to provoke her severely to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year after year. As often as she went to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. So there's a bit of cattiness going on here amongst the two. Anyway, Hannah wept and wouldn't eat. Her husband Elkanah said to Hannah, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" So I love this. I could just, this is something I think we can identify with. It's some bloke, his wife's upset, she's cut to the quick, and all the husband can say is, "Hey, you got me. I'm here. Shouldn't you be happy?" I mean, this is the photo album, right? This is, my father-in-law's just like that. okay, so some of these things are little, but you can see, you can touch the humanity of some of these comments. Okay, I think anyway. So let's go on. So, well, you know the story, what happens. She prays, and then let's go over to verse 21. Then the man Elkanah and all his household went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. So this is after the baby. But Hannah didn't go up. She said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I'll bring him, that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and remain there. And then he'll be a Nazarite." And her husband Elkanah said, "Do what you seems best to you. Wait till you've weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son and she weaned him. So for me, when I read that, it's just, I just get an image of my mother. You can imagine a mum, the whole story is a hard setting, but she wants to look after the little one. "I don't want to travel. I just want to look after the little one." Then eventually she will go up. So start of our, what are we seeing at the start of our journey through this photo album? We run into a cocky father, which we can relate to, thinking that his presence should be enough. But you also start to see the mother's care for a little one. And you can see that throughout the pages of Scripture. And it's a nice read to see the cases of how mothers cared for the little ones, just like they do today. It's human beings, of course, right? So this stuff's going to be fairly obvious. But you can also find cases in the photo album of the father's care for a little child, and I've got one here that's quite interesting. It's in 2 Kings, so you can come across to 2 Kings, and we'll read about, I would almost say, a typical father's care. 2 Kings, chapter 4. Where am I going? I start Samuel, then Kings is next. 2 Kings 4, and verse 8. So one day, Elisha. So this is now a story with Elisha in it. Elisha was passing through Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived, who urged him to have a meal. So when he passed that way, he would stop there for a meal. She said to her husband, "Look, I'm sure this man who regularly passes our way is a holy man of God. Let us make a small room chamber with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair and a lamp so he can stay there wherever he comes to us." So you see this hospitality which you can spot today as well with families being kind to others, but this is not the father's kindness I want to show you. So one day he came there. He went to the chamber and he lay down. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite woman." And when he had called her, she stood before him. He said to him, "Say to her, since you've taken all this trouble with us, what may be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?" So this is the prophet, but it's quintessential bloke to me. It's like, I've got no idea what to give. I feel like I should do something good. I've got no idea what it is. He reads on. She answers, "I live among my own people.
And he said, what may be done for her? So this is later, and he's asking his servant, well, what can I do for her? The servant says, well, she has no son, and her husband is old.
You'd think that should be a fairly obvious thing, but anyway, this guy, is sort of, the prophet, is kind of lost up in things. But the servant, Gehazi, realizes, it's the son. That would be the thing that she would love. And so he said, call her. When he called her, she stood at the door. He said, at this season, in due time, you shall embrace a son. Still haven't got to the father's care yet, but this is just the background. She replied, no, my Lord, O man of God, don't deceive your servant. So again, so often you see in the Bible strong faith, but there's cases here where this is exactly how I imagine you'd react. Someone would say, you haven't had kids, are you going to have a kid? The first thing the woman says is, don't trick me. Anyway, we know the story. She has the baby, and then we read over in 17, the woman conceived, bore a son at that season in due time, just as Elisha had declared to her. So now we're coming to the father's care. Then the child was older. He went out one day to his father among the reapers. He complained to his father, oh, my head, my head. And the father said to his servant, carry him to his mother. So to me, this is quintessential father. I'm busy. My boy's got a head. He'll be all right. Just carry him to his mother. He didn't even do it himself. Okay, maybe I'm giving, like I said, this is my personal view of the photo album. It seems to be, this is the sort of thing I could imagine the father. He's going to be fine. And as the ladies would be probably quick to point out, the father was totally wrong. The kid was very sick. And it's a bit sad, but he did die. But then Elisha, God raised him back again later. Okay, a rather strange thing, but it's part of the photo album. To me, this was something that we can see the likeness with, of the father's way of dealing with a little child. All right, so let's move on. These children that we're reading about, probably, we don't know the age, but after weaning, maybe 3 or 4. And then there's the story of weaning, of course, in Genesis 21 of Isaac. And so we'll read that young child story before moving on. So where did I say we'd go? Genesis 21. So Genesis 21 and verse 5 to 9. So now this is the story of Isaac. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. So again, you have some things like this in Scripture, and you say, well, it's hard to identify with this, 100-year-old having a child. But we read on, and I think we can see the humanity come out. So now Sarah said, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. Because we know she laughed when she was told that she was going to have a child in her old age. Well, she did. And then she said, who would ever have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I've borne him a son in his old age. So then the child grew and was weaned. So I think that's around maybe between 2 and 4 years old. I think that's roughly where we are now. So we're away from the birth in the photo album, but we're starting to get the age of weaning. Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. And in other translations it says picking on him or mocking him. So you've got something here which I think through the ages comes down, kids picking on each other. One's getting a bit of a feast, the older one, a bit grumpy. And then the mother, the matter was very distressing to Abraham. Sorry. So Sarah says to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac. Okay, so it's a complicated story, and we know it has large ramifications. Paul refers to it in a very deep way, but in a very simple way. To me, this is something that we can see the likeness of. The kids at school are getting picked on. Mum calls up the principal and says, look, I want you to fix this problem. Get rid of the kid teasing my kid. To me, this echoes through time. I don't mean to be picking on the ladies. It might sound like I am. But anyway, the humanity comes through the centuries here, to me. All right, so let's read on now. So that's weaning. So that's about 3 to 4. So now as we flick through the photo album, we come to the next thing I could find for a youngster was Jesus at 12. So let's go to Luke 2:41, and we can read and exploit a story about a 12-year-old.
Luke 2:41.
Now, every year, his parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, so that's Jesus, they went up as usual for the festival. When the festival was ended, they started to return. The boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but his parents didn't know it. And so this is something I can relate to, because I remember once going to church and my parents went home without me. Mum hates me telling the story, so I'm kind of glad that she's not here today. They were convinced, Jesus' mum was, they were convinced that I was with another church family. And I can vividly remember it through this day coming out, and there was no parents left at church, and I was a little upset, and eventually didn't have mobile phones. So anyway, somehow, I can't remember what happened. Someone was contacted, and I got popped off. Anyway, so to me, when I read this, okay, this is personal stuff. You might think it's a bit strange, but I'm kind of reading this to try and help you maybe spend some time looking at the scripture in this not too light a way, but to make the identification with it. So for me, this is a story. Yep, I understand it. There's something going here. I was, in my case, I was chasing a kid to get 2 cents, but in Jesus had a nobler reason, of course. He was, they assume he was in the group. And they went a day's journey. So they went for 1 day without bothering about it. Then they started to look for him among their relatives and friends. And when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him. So you can just imagine parents doing this. Mum must be out of her wits with this. After 3 days, they found him in the temple. So 3 days. So I don't know how he was. Anyway, he was looking after himself you can imagine a 12-year-old, right? For him, the temple is like, I don't know, the train yard. Like you can go playing with the trains or the trucks. So this was his. This was his thing, and he just wanted to be amongst it. He was there sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. All who heard him were amazed at his understanding, of course. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. Of course, his mother said, "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety." To me, quintessential, it's exactly what a mum would do today. And so this is 2,000 years ago. So, okay, maybe I'm being a bit frivolous. I'm not talking about the lesson that we learn from it, but rather just the identification from it. So I hope that's all right for you, and I'll keep reading, because now we flip the pages of the photo album, and so that's 12, and we saw things to identify with, I think, at least I did. Next, I think, I've got my notes here, is to go to Joseph, to read Joseph. So we meet Joseph when he is 17. So let's flick back to there. So that's in Genesis 37. Oh, I forgot to put my timer on. Have we gone about 10 minutes?
We've been going 18 minutes.
Oh dear. Okay. Got about 10 to go, right? So we are in Genesis 37 looking for Joseph. And so we're going to read from verse 1 to 8. So Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old. Okay, so we meet him at 17. I'm sure we've got people here who are 17. His life is a bit different from ours, but he had some things that we have to face when we're teenagers. So when he was shepherding his flock with his brothers, he was a helper to the sons of Bilhah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report to them, to their father. And now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him this robe with the colours and so on. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than their brothers. They hated him and couldn't speak peaceably to him. All of us can remember in our teenagers, that often you run across people that will hate you. For some reason, teenagers like to do this to each other. And if it didn't happen to you, fantastic. In Joseph's case, it was his own brothers that gave him a real rough trot. Once Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to the dream I dreamed. Here we were binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose upright, then your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf." So maybe he wasn't wise in sharing this story to his brothers. And look, as teenagers, we're not wise either, right? So to me, this is, okay, it's something rather extraordinary, but you can still see yourself in amongst it.
There's even a point of identity here, is that we have a promise. And he's got, he had this promise. This dream about his brothers bowing down was a kind of a promise to him. So our teenagers have the same promise. Of course, they're not. I don't think our guys are telling their friends at school that the sheaves are bowing down to him. But nevertheless, it's a promise that we have. And what did how did his brothers respond? Are you really going to reign over us? And so they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. So Joseph, a 17-year-old, knew what it was like to be unpopular with his mates, his brothers even. To me, this is a point of identity. I remember times where you have trouble amongst your peers. Of course, it got very rough for Joseph. And if we drop down to chapter 39 and verse 5... we know the story. He ends up in grief in Egypt, but he puts his shoulder to the wheel, so to speak, works hard, and benefits from it. This is exactly the experience that I know some of the youngsters here have had, working hard, and that's respected. And this was exactly for the case of Joseph. Despite the situation, it was not the job that he chose. To the contrary, he put his shoulder down, he worked hard, he worked diligently, and he received favour from Potiphar. Then things went a bit pear-shaped. So let's catch that there, because I think this is a point of identity for our young ones as well. So from the time that he made him overseer of his house, so he got promoted, he did well, he was promoted, and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And I've certainly seen that in the lives of young people in the church, of benefits surrounding them as they try to put God's way into practice and work hard in the workplace. Not always, but sometimes. The blessing of the Lord was in all that he had. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. So the trust increased and Joseph had this opportunity to basically run the show. And without him, there was no concern for anything but the food that he ate. Now Joseph was handsome and good looking. And some of us can identify with that. maybe not with what comes next though. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." So a very, very forward lady, a married lady, and we can have all sorts of thinking about this, but the reality is that our young ones in the world are faced with this sort of behaviour. This is what goes on. So, I mean, it's a bit awkward to talk about it. You know, he refused and he said, "Look, I can't do this. He's given me everything. I can't take you as well. He's kept back nothing from me. How could I do this wickedness and sin against God?" And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not consent to lie with her or be with her. So good on him. So he's a young guy. He's not 17 here, but he's not a great deal older, I don't think. It's probably years. I can't prove that for sure. But he's being faced with exactly what our young ones face regularly, and our older ones as well, in this world. Sex and the temptation for it is enormous. But it's nothing new. I mean, kind of reading this stuff, it's in the photo album, right? The people have walked this path and overcome it. And so it's possible not to get sucked into it. So this is a tremendous example, and we can identify with him. He's picked on, he tries to do the right thing, he gets the favour, and then he's getting too much favour. He's like, "Oh man, now what am I going to do?" So one day he went into his house to do his work. We know the story, right? Well, no one was else in the house. She grabbed him, caught hold of his garment and said, "Lie with me." Crumbs, she was forward. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. So I think there's an example here as well. Leave the party. Don't hang around when this stuff gets pressured. But anyway, what happened? She saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside. She called to the members of the household and said, "See, my husband has brought among a Hebrew to insult us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And when he heard me raise my voice and cry out, he left his garment beside me. He fled outside." So total fabrication. She kept his garment by her until his master came home, and she told him the same story. "Hebrew servant whom you brought amongst us came to insult me." I think assault would be the reality. "But as soon as I raised my voice, he left. And the master heard the words, 'Is this the way you've done it?' And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison." So I think we can identify with this. You try and do the right thing, and don't expect to be patted on the back. People that might like you one minute, you show that you don't want to be part of what they're doing, they'll turn against you. They'll hate your guts. You probably won't end up in prison, but it won't be a nice place. This is the stuff that happens now. So this story is
This is before. This is about 3,500 years ago.
It's the same sort of emotions and passions and things that exist today. So of course it's relevant what he does. What a cracking example that Joseph has set us. But how do you deal with it when you do the right thing and you don't get all the patting on the back, which you can see in the Bible?
Well, in the photo album, it's not always patting on the back. A lot of times the guys did the right thing and they ended up in more trouble, it would seem.
This is a very, very common thing as you flip through the photo album. I mean, it's here for Joseph. He's doing the right thing and it goes totally, totally pear-shaped. Let's go to another case. Let's go to flip over to 1 Kings 19.
So we're advancing. We're probably jumping the age a bit here. I don't know. This is back to Elijah. I'm not sure how old he is now. So maybe I'm jumping a bit. It's not really teenager anymore. But it's in the section of the photo album where we see people doing the right thing and having things go pear-shaped instead of what you'd like to think. I do the right thing and everything goes well. So what's this case? We meet Elijah here in circumstances that look nothing like what we experience today. He's just called fire down from heaven. He's had a massive success, a massive triumph in the face of everyone. He's been part of killing 300 or so prophets, so it's very hard to relate to this. But let's read what happens, and I think we'll find that we can relate to it. So Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, all these prophets and fire and stuff. And this is 19 of 1 Kings. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. Lovely lady, this. So may the gods do to me, and more also, if I don't make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. Elijah just gets a death threat. I mean, we haven't had this extreme, of course, but what he does, I think we can totally relate to. Then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life. So to me, this brings it to life. This is exactly what you'd want to do, right? Jezebel comes and threatens your life. You just want to get out of here. I'm scared. I want to go. This is the human side of Elijah here, I think. Well, obviously it is. And we came to Judah and he left his servant there. And then we flip down and, we can keep reading. He came and sat down under a broom tree. Again, you say, well, how do I relate to this? Well, then he says, he asked God that he might die. It's enough now, Lord. Take away my life. I am no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep again. So this is exactly the sort of response that we can relate to in life. Maybe it hasn't happened yet, but it's a high probability because the number of times throughout Scripture you see God's people, throughout the photo album if you like, doing the right thing, and getting it in the neck afterwards, and they get discouraged, as totally you'd expect a human would. So I've found cases where Job wanted to die. He wished he was dead. You can read Jonah, of course. He said, God, kill me. I want to die. Jeremiah got to the point where he wanted to die. He said, I've had enough of this. I just want to die. Moses even said, unless you're going to do something here, I just want to die. Kill me. It's something that it's throughout the photo album that, in a sense, I won't say it's meant to be, but in a sense, when things don't go to plan, when you do the right thing, it's not surprising that you end up in a deep place, in a dark place. This guy here, I mean, I've read over this so many times, but I realised he was in a very dark, mentally and spiritually dark place. He had enough. He just wanted to sleep. He wanted it all to go away. I suspect when he laid down, he thought he wasn't going to wake up. He said, God, I want to die. He gives you the rationale of his feeling a bit more detail in verse 10. He says, look, I've been very zealous for the Lord of hosts. I've been doing the right thing, he says. The Israelites have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. And now the prophets, they've killed the prophets. And now I'm left and they're seeking to kill me. So he's totally a very Joseph type situation, if you like. And like I said, you can read these throughout the scriptures. One of the amazing parts of the photo album is the book of Psalms. Because there, you don't even just get the pictures of the characters. You actually get what they were praying and what they were begging God for. And, of course, there's the famous psalm where David is saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? The very things that Jesus Christ prayed when he was on the cross. If you're at a point when you're thinking that this is ceasing to be relevant or that your circumstance is unique, and of course it is always unique in its own way, but so often is commonalities with these other greats. And so I think it is nice sometimes to look through the photo album to find the cases where the guys ended up in difficult places and the ladies, and to realise, and then of course, which we're not going to do now, and to study how they got out of them or how God helped them through it. And that's the encouraging thing. But for the moment, if we can just keep flipping through, we sort of got to teenage years, then we've explored a little bit of things going wrong, even though you're doing the right thing. What comes next in the photo album, of course, are boyfriends and girlfriends. That's what we see next as we flip through the photo album. And nice love stories that you can come across in the photo album is Genesis 29. For the case of Jacob. So if we can go there. So often when you think about marriage and relationships in the Bible, it sounds so different than today. It's like how on earth could this be relevant? There was a good message on the United site by a guy called Tim Pedworth that goes through and looks at some of the relevance of scriptural times to today even. And this one to me, this sounds close. When you read what is happening here with the love of Jacob to Rachel, you just get an impression that it's still the same passion and desire and the love that we see in relationships that we experience, as opposed to these arranged marriages, which is what first comes to mind. Okay, you're going to marry this, king's daughter's going to marry that king daughter, and so on. Anyway, so let's just read this section of the photo album. So we're at Genesis 29, verse 9. So this is now Jacob going back to where his mum's family was from. While he was still speaking, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. Now when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother Laban, the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep, Jacob went up, rolled the stone from the well's mouth, and watered the flock. So smoothie. So to me, this is something you can relate to. A young guy, there's the pretty lady. I'll go. I'll do the good deed. Be chivalrous. I'll roll the stone away from the well's mouth. So he does. So when I read this, it doesn't exactly remind me of my youth, but there's something in there that you identify with. He's rolling the stone away and he's watering the flock of that Rachel has. Then Jacob kisses Rachel. So that's always a smooth thing to do, right? Give a little give a little peck on the cheek. And then he cried. And I've learned that ladies actually like it when a guy cries. So this guy had read the book. He was chivalrous. He did okay, maybe I'm being a little bit frivolous, but there's something here you can, as you read on, you capture with Jacob and his love to Rachel. And Jacob told Rachel that he was his father's kinsman. And then it goes on. Then Laban heard about the news. He ran to meet him, and you know they all get together. And then as you read down, it says Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were lovely, but Rachel was graceful and beautiful. And Jacob loved Rachel. And so he said, I'll serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, well, okay, it's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel. And they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Now, to me, when I read the scriptures, I don't see that sort of thing very often. It's so mechanical, you know. And so this is something for me, when I read this, look, it's the same. That chemistry, it's the same. They had the same chemistry, he did. And so these 7 years, I don't understand exactly how 7 years can seem quickly, but for him, he was head over heels, and he did his 7 years' time. We will leave the story there, because that does go a bit pear-shaped, and I sort of want to leave it on a good note. Anyway, that snapshot, to me, that's something, a point of identification. We can, at least for me, there's something there that bridges the centuries. So now, okay, so that was the marriage part of the, it's worth reading, because what Laban does do, before he does his little tricky stuff, he throws a big feast. And so back then they had marriage feasts. And then, of course, there's the story of what did Jesus Christ choose to do his first miracle on? It was a wedding feast. So 2,000 years ago, wedding was involved with a feasting. There was wine. This is something that happens today. And 2,000 years ago, they were doing the same thing. And Jesus Christ valued it and made his first miracle around it. So there's the part of the photo album where you see the celebrations over the weddings. And then, of course, what happens next? Well, then there's childbirth. And I can't remember. It was someone we were talking to recently, and they were complaining that their mum never told them how painful it was going to be. But that's in the photo album. You see it right from Eve. God said it's going to be painful. I'm sure for the ladies when they read that all of the Rachel and the others travailing in their labour, it's a point of identification for them. For guys, of course, you sort of see it from more academic, but I'm sure for ladies reading the scriptures, when they read those passages, it's a point of identification. It was painful for them then as it is for us now. But of course, the pain doesn't stop with childbirth, does it? For the mum, especially. And so if we could turn now to Proverbs 31, because even though this sounds something, it seems something so far away and so idealistic, I think in Proverbs 31 there's a lot for ladies to identify with. So we're making good progress. We're up to the point where we're in the photo album where there's children arriving and a lot of the mum. So let's go to Proverbs 31:15. And this is mum. She rises while it is still night and provides food for the household and tasks for the servant girls. I mean, the servant girls bit, I bet a lot of the ladies wish there was there. But certainly getting up very, very early to help look after the family is something that thousands of years ago the mum was doing. For the mums that do it now, they can identify with that. And then it goes on, because you can read in verse 18, she perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp doesn't go out at night. So she's staying up really, really late as well, burning the candles both ends, just like a lot of mums I've seen do today. Interestingly, as you read this, you can see, well, what's the husband doing while all this work is going on? And unfortunately, this is a point of identification as well. In verse 23... he just takes his seat amongst the elders, sitting on his butt while the wife's doing all the work. And I know sometimes in my household this is a point of identification because my job's a desk job. Jeanette hasn't said it, but I know that she identifies with this part of Scripture. You're sitting there talking away. Anyway, what am I saying this for? I hope I'm not being frivolous with this, but there's so much of the Scripture that is similar to us, that we do identify with. They walked in similar shoes. There are lots of likenesses. Look at verse 16, for instance. She considers a field and buys it. That's what a husband learns very soon after getting married. Spending money becomes something pretty major. And back then it was as well. I know he's a flip side of this. You think he trusts his wife. But the reality is money suddenly starts to leave the bank account at an enhanced rate. There's no denying that. That's what happens. And then as the children grow, and you flip through the photo album of scriptures, I'll just go to one here, and it's the Proverbs of Solomon in Proverbs 10, verse 1. It says, a wise child makes a glad father. So when your children make wise decisions, the father experiences the joy. So back then, and when Proverbs was written 3,000 years ago, Solomon was saying, yep, there is a real joy of a father when he sees his child making good decisions. But then the next phrase, but a foolish child is a mother's grief. And I know that when the children make bad decisions, the mother is there feeling it as well. And I wonder, I put this to you, and I don't know if it's a fact or not, but a lot of times when I've read Proverbs, I've wondered why it bothered saying things that were really obvious. A lot of things, it says like, a rich man has lots of money. Well, it doesn't say that, but there's times I've been reading it and it just seems something. And this is one, okay, mum's going to be happy when the kids... But I wonder if it's all those things are a point to say, look, relate to this. This is the same now as it was then. Relate to what I'm saying. And so in between, it gives you extra insight. And I guess the reason I say that is that when We're talking about science before, but sometimes in science what you do is you say and show things that everybody knows. So in other words, you prove that you can develop things and test things that everybody knows. And then you say, well, look, my methodology is right, therefore the next step, please come with me on it. And I wonder if some of the Proverbs are like that. They're telling you things that are really obvious, so then the next step, when he gives you something a bit insightful, you go with him because you realise that he's been right with all this. Anyway, that's just a little bit of something for you. And so parents understand this, relate to this. The joys of the children making right decisions and the grief of the mother when the child doesn't is something that transcends time. So what happens next? So now kids are growing. We must be getting near the end of the message, and we are. End of the photo album. Okay, there's an interesting one I'd like to go to in 2 Kings chapter 2. And you won't be expecting this one, but we'd love to hear which one you might go to now. So 2 Kings 2:23. And this is Elisha. He went up from there to Bethel. And while he was going up along the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, saying, "Go away, bald head, go away, bald head." So what happens next in the relationship is the man starts to lose his hair and he gets bald. People pick on him. Again, this is a personal thing. This scripture came to mind because it stuck in my head that young people were teasing old people for being bald 3,000 years ago. And they still do it today. I get it a little bit, and my brothers get it as well. That's something to identify with. What would be cool every now and then is... No, it wouldn't be, but what happened next is rather alarming. I'll read it because this is hard to relate to, but sometimes you feel like it. So when he turned around and he saw them, he cursed them, and two she-bears came out of the woods and mauled them. So... They don't pick on me for being bald. All right, so, okay, now you're balding. The guys, they're balding. And then, of course, you come to that amazing part of Scripture that Jeanette's mum asked me to read out at her father's funeral. And I'd never really appreciated it until I was sort of reading it in front of a funeral. And that's Ecclesiastes 12. So I'll just read that because... Nothing's changed. It's still, well, I'd say nothing's changed, but there's so many commonalities. So let's read this. Now we're in the twilight of life. Remember your Creator, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, in the days of your youth. For the years draw near when you will say, I have no pleasure anymore in them. The sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened. The clouds return with the rain. I'm just going to keep reading because it's kind of nice poetry. In the day when the guards of the house tremble, the strong men are bent. The women who grind cease working because they're few. Those who look through the windows see dimly. When the doors of the street are shut and the sound of the grinding is low, one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. When one is afraid of heights and terrors are in the road, the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails. Because all must go to their eternal home, the mourners will go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped and the golden bowl is broken, and the pitcher is broken at the fountain, and the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the breath returns to God who gave it. So life ends, and it doesn't end gloriously, just like this says. I mean, there's lovely poetry in this, and there's nice analogies of the white almond tree and the grey hair and the things not working, the teeth not working, you can't sleep, and... things that I know are probably in store for me pretty soon. And so it ends. So there's the photo album. That's a snapshot of it, and you've probably got your own. And the young ones I really encourage to think of this as something that is really relevant for many reasons. And today it's just been one small aspect that the similarities are extraordinary in the heart, the passions, the experiences, the pressures that we have today. We have our own version, our sophisticated version, but they're pulling the same strings. They're pushing the same things. So the things that help these guys and ladies help us. There's a continuity of this. These are our, if you like, forebears, our family, our extended family. And so to conclude then, I'll read one scripture from Ecclesiastes and then one in Corinthians to try and...
bring the more serious point out of it. So what does it say in Ecclesiastes 1:10? Basically what I just said. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It's already been in the ages before us. So if you're in a difficult stretch and there's a difficult problem and you think it's uniquely yours, it quite possibly isn't. It will feel like it and it will have aspects that are unique, but there's so much of it that someone will have felt before and have dealt with it before, and God strengthened them, and you can find hints of it in the Scripture. There's a lot of stuff that's dysfunctional that we haven't touched today that you can find in the Scriptures if you think your dysfunctional situation is unique. Now, of course, it quite possibly is in many facets, but I think it's worth focusing on these aspects where there's commonality. So in 1 Corinthians 10:13, he says the same. Paul says the sort of same sort of thing, and we can just close with that. 1 Corinthians 10:13. He says, no testing has overtaken you that is not common to everyone. So the things that you're facing and fighting and dealing with are common. In one sense, they're common. They're you, because you have a unique personality. And that's the kind of a cool thing of what God's doing. He's building different character in all of us. But there is a real commonality to what we're experiencing. He says, God is faithful. He will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, he'll provide a way out so that you may be able to endure it. So in closing, these 3,000 plus characters in the Scripture, they're like Elijah, humans like us. And their life stories are very relevant today. All done. Any questions? Comments?
The brothers fighting with Joseph, but that really goes back from the really beginning. That was with Cain and Abel. And Cain was jealous or whatever of his brother. So it's a common theme all the way through. You know, brothers or families have jealousies, and they can come out in all sorts of ways.
Certainly jealousy is behind some of the most heinous crimes of humanity, really. Cain killing Abel, all the way to Christ getting killed. Behind it is a jealousy. And jealousy today is as strong as ever, isn't it? We just learn to dress it up a little bit better sometimes. Yeah, you're right. But...
Matthew, there was one I wondered that you might have included was the example of Moses taking advice from his father.
Intentionally left out. If there's anything he doesn't need, is encouragement.
But that one I couldn't relate to because he took it so well. You just imagine him, oh, I suppose you're right.
Matthew, I thought it was good the way you pointed the difficulties that people deal with.